From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today, cracking the longest and costliest case in FBI history. James Fitzgerald is a criminal profiler who joined the hunt for the Unabomber after he'd eluded capture for 17 years, killing three people and injuring many more. The man eventually identified as Ted Kaczynski had been obsessively careful not to leave clues in the explosives he mailed his victims.
He was so cautious, he would rip the skins off of the batteries themselves, so even the lot number that almost every product out there has couldn't even be traced to a region of the country.
Fitzgerald focused on the language in the Unabomber's writing for clues. His work is the basis for a new series on the Discovery Channel. Also performer Bridget Everett. She's known for her raunchy comedy cabaret act. Now she co-stars in the new movie Patty Cakes. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the first book published by Lena Dunham's Lenny imprint. First news. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. Not many criminal investigations last 17 years, but from 1978 to 1995, a man who came to be known as the Unabomber conducted a personal campaign of terror by sending bombs through the U.S. mail, killing three people and injuring many more. The bomber was careful not to leave clues to his identity or whereabouts, and the case was broken in part by careful analysis of the language he used in letters and polemics. He turned out to be an ideologically motivated hermit named Ted Kaczynski, who's now serving a life sentence in prison. Our guest today, James R. Fitzgerald, is a retired FBI agent and criminal profiler who played a critical role in the case by extracting clues from the language in the Unabomber's writings. Fitz, as he was known, is the central character in a new scripted miniseries on the Discovery Channel called Manhunt: The Unabomber. It airs Tuesday nights at 10. The series opens with a voiceover in which the Unabomber, played by Paul Bettany, reflects on the U.S. mail and how remarkable it is that he can get a package to anyone with just an address and some stamps.
And you see, it only works because every single person along the chain acts like a mindless automaton. I write an address and they just obey. No question, no deviation, no pause to contemplate eternity or beauty or death. Even you, for all your protestations of free will, if a box comes with your name on it, you can't even imagine doing anything other than obey.
Morning.
Hey.
There you go. Thank you.
Well, it's not your fault. Society made you this way.
Thank you.
But you're a sheep. And you're living in a world of sheep. And because you're all sheep, because all you can do is obey, I can reach out and touch anyone. Anywhere. I can reach out and touch you right now.
And that is from the Discovery Channel series Manhunt: Unabomber, which is based in large part on the work of our guest, James R. Fitzgerald, who is an FBI agent on the case, known as Fitz to everyone. Fitz, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, Dave. It's great to be here.
Good to have you. So when you joined the Unabomber Task Force, it was years and years into this bombing campaign. How many bombs had the Unabomber planted or mailed by then? How many people had he harmed?
By the time I came on board in July of 95, the investigation was already 17 years long. There had been 16 bombings, sometimes two in the same year, and there had also been 14 letters written. And of course, the granddaddy of them all was the article, which the media came to know as the manifesto. So we're dealing with the low to mid-teens in these very pertinent numbers of the Unabom case when I first got on board.
Three people had been killed, many seriously injured.
And an airplane almost brought down if it wasn't for the valiant efforts of the pilots to do an emergency landing.
Many FBI agents working on this for years, what did they have on the Unabom?
Virtually nothing. And it has nothing to do with the hard work that was put into it, not only by the FBI, but other federal agencies and in the very beginning, some local agencies in the Chicago area and some other parts of the U.S. It's just that we knew early on, and I'm saying we, I wasn't quite involved in the early days, but we knew that this individual was a criminal mastermind. We knew he was smarter than most other criminals we were going up against. And the one reason was because there was absolutely no evidence on the explosive devices themselves.
Which is remarkable. He's mailing things which blow up and leave pieces, batteries that might have serial numbers.
Nothing. In fact, he was so cautious, he would rip the skins off of the batteries themselves. So even the lot number that, you know, almost every product out there has some kind of a lot number, almost every one of those couldn't be traced to a region of the country. And he had to glue certain parts together. He didn't want to buy commercial glue. So the laboratory, the FBI laboratory, determined he was melting deer hooves to, in fact, create this epoxy that he would then use to glue certain parts together. This is how hard he was working to make sure no evidence at all existed. And, of course, no fingerprints, no DNA, nothing like that.
Tell us just a little bit about his victims. Who were they? How many?
Well, that was obviously a big part of the Unabom task force and me as a profiler coming in. We in profiling have a term known as victimology. The victims that a serial offender chooses, be it a serial rapist, serial killer, serial bank robber conceivably, tells us a lot about what is pushing this person to commit these type of crimes. So the problem with the Unabomber, though, is they seemed relatively random and disparate, and you just couldn't really there was no nexus between them. Of course, early on, the acronym UNABOM itself stands for University Airline Bombings. A now long forgotten FBI bureaucrat came up with that acronym, and it stuck from the early 80s on. But the earliest victims were involving airlines and universities, so we figured this person may have an issue with airlines, and that's where the whole, you know, laid off United Airlines mechanic theory came in. It couldn't be dismissed right away, and I never did, but I said we may have something else. We want to expand our horizons here. And certainly university, what's this guy's problem with universities? Was he kicked out of a school, never admitted to the school he wanted to get into? We didn't dream in the early days that he actually held a PhD and was a college professor for 2 years at Berkeley. Then he expanded a little bit to his victim selection, and it was computer-type stores or related-type professors to computer science. And then it became a marketing executive, Thomas Moser, in northern New Jersey. And then Gil Murray was his very last victim, the third death on his 16th bombing, and that was a forestry lobbyist in Sacramento, California. And it turns out the last two were chosen because Moser's firm represented the Exxon Valdez oil spill, or Exxon, I should say, about the Valdez spill in Alaska 5 or 10 years before. And the forestry lobbyist was selected because a sawmill opened up down the road from Kaczynski, and he didn't like hearing the buzzsaw in the morning, so he attacked them. I should go back real quick. The airline part was because a plane flew over his head twice a day at 35,000 feet, and he saw the contrails, and that bothered him. That took away from his tranquility living on the mountainside in Montana, and he said, darn it, I'm going to start bombing airlines. We actually read that in his own journal. So you never know how a serial offender is choosing his victims. He was getting the information out of Who's Who, a book that can be found in every library now, probably online. So that's the tangled web that he wove in terms of choosing his various victims. And it really was hard to put any dotted lines at all among them.
The Unabom Task Force was located in San Francisco because that was the area where most of the packages had been mailed from, right?
Certainly, and let's go back a little bit in time, Dave, but the Unabomber offended from 78 to 87. He, I think it was about 12 to 13 bombings at that time. But in 1987 is when a witness inside a computer store looked out the window as the Unabomber was putting down one of his devices. And that's where that iconic composite sketch comes from.
This is the one with the aviator sunglasses and the hood. Right?
Absolutely. And that was about the only real lead that the FBI or any agency had up until 1987. That's 9 years into this bombing campaign. Then the Unabomber goes dormant for six entire years. And I wasn't involved in the case at all at this point, but we're hearing rumors. You know, he killed himself practicing his bomb-making techniques. He got arrested for something else. Or, as in some case we know with serial offenders, sometimes they get married, they have kids, they move on to other jobs, whatever, and they lose interest in what they're doing. But all of a sudden, in 1993, the Unabomber comes back with a vengeance, and that's when the bombs were more lethal, and he decided to tell people about his organization, FC, and that's when the whole case started coming together even more so.
Right. He would sign things FC, standing for Freedom Club.
That's what he claimed, Freedom Club. We were never sure exactly if he meant that or not, but in one of his letters to the New York Times, he described what FC stood for.
So when you were assigned to this case in 1995, is that right?
That is correct.
You were relatively new as a profiler. You had been recently trained. And you focused on the language in this manifesto that he wrote that he wanted published and other letters he had sent. And you spoke to a linguistics professor early on who had taken a deep look at this manifesto that the Unabomber had sent. So when you looked at this text carefully, what are some of the things you discovered?
I spent 2 hours with this linguist. His name is Roger Shai. He had just retired from the linguistics department at Georgetown University. And it was right at the tail end of my profiling training and nothing to do with the actual training. We set this up separate. And for 2 hours, I just sat almost, not literally, but almost at his knees like he was my Yoda. And he's just sort of explaining to me in layman's terms the science of linguistics, which, of course, is the scientific study of language. Now, Dave, I already had a master's degree in organizational psychology, so I certainly was familiar with psychological factors, but really I never studied all that much into the way of language. I've always been a good crossword puzzle doer. My mother taught me that at an early age. I played Scrabble. I love cryptograms. Language always fascinated me. And all of a sudden now I'm looking at this thing, and I'm reading it two times, three times, four times. It's a very dense document, Dave. But before too long, I'm picking up on some unusual language characteristics, like some archaic terms, like broad and chick to denote women. Okay, what does he mean by that? He uses the word Negro to refer to African Americans. And this is 1995, and these words were, it's almost like, you know, Frank Sinatra language or something you'd hear from a 50s movie or something. That helped me sort of age the author to begin with.
So he's probably older and kind of has his language frozen in an earlier era.
Yeah.
You know, let me just at this point, Fitz, you like to go by Fitz. The manifesto itself, what was its message? I mean, you looked at the language and clues he left without meaning to, but what was his message in this?
Essentially, technology is evil. And human nature, we've now evolved to a point where technology was controlling us instead of us controlling it. And his ultimate solution around the 150th chapter or paragraph, and conveniently he numbered each paragraph, 212 of them total. And it came down to his solution to all of this is we should basically disband our technological system that we have created for ourselves and live in agrarian based tribes of no more than 30 people. And until people listened to him and took him seriously, or at least published his article, he would continue bombing people to get his point across. So it really comes down to his dislike of technology and the world in which he lived, and apparently in which he did not succeed very well.
Right. So as you looked through this 35,000-word document, you were looking for clues that he didn't mean to leave, that might tell you something about who he is. What else did you find?
Well, I actually read the whole manifesto in one of my flights out to San Francisco, and actually the first time I missed it, what I'm about to tell you, and that is in paragraph 185. It's a short paragraph, only about three sentences or so, but he ends it with, well, you can't eat your cake and have it too. Now, the first time I didn't notice anything unusual about that, because I'm trying to grab so many other clues all around this, but the second time I read it, well, you can't eat your cake and have it too, I caught myself and said, wait a minute, we don't say it that way. We say we or you, whatever, can't have your cake and eat it too. He somehow transposed the verbs. And Dave, I got to tell you, having read this now two solid times, this was one of the only mistakes, quote unquote mistakes, that I found in the entire manifesto/article, as he called it.
James R. Fitzgerald is a retired FBI agent and criminal profiler. His work is the basis for the Discovery Channel scripted miniseries Manhunt Unabomber. We'll hear more of his story after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, offering a way to buy home insurance with their Home Quote Explorer tool. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive. And from Home Advisor, matching homeowners with background-checked professionals for a variety of home projects, from minor repairs to major remodels. Homeowners can read reviews, compare prices, and book appointments online at homeadvisor.com.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with James R. Fitzgerald, a retired FBI agent and criminal profiler whose work is the basis for a new scripted miniseries called Manhunt Unabomber on the Discovery Channel. Fitzgerald looked for clues to the Unabomber's identity in his writings, including a 35,000-word treatise that came to be known as The Manifesto. So the Unabomber had mailed this lengthy manifesto about his political views, which you were studying for clues, but he mailed it with an offer of sorts. What was his deal?
His bargain, I think is the word he actually used, was he wanted the New York Times or the Washington Post to publish it. So, of course, the debate began right away within FBI quarters, within the media, within other political circles. Do we accede to the demands of a terrorist? And it was almost a 50-50 split. How do we handle this? What do we do? And at this point, you know, I'm a supervisor in the FBI. I'm being invited into the daily supervisory meetings of the UTF management.
Unabomber Task Force.
Yeah. Unabomber Task Force management. And I was invited there. And I sat quiet through some of it. I'm the new guy on the block. I'm just kind of feeling my way around the task force. And then all of a sudden, you know, we started talking about the manifesto. And there's a few people, absolutely do not publish this thing. Every nut will come out of the woodwork and want to get their own, you know, paragraph or 20-page document published. And who's going to read this thing anyway? And I said, people are going to read this thing. He has a lot to say here. And I was even saying back then, there are some things in here he kind of has right. He's on the money. Now, we all agreed, and to this day, you don't kill or bomb people to make your point. But even back then, I was saying, you know, people are going to find this to be very interesting, and they are going to read it. And I said, someone out there, and I wish I was the first one to say, you know, a family member will notice it, but I basically focused on a professor, a teacher, a colleague, maybe some newspaper editor who takes in the letters from somebody. And I said, it could be a family member, a lover, somebody is going to recognize this writing style and this odd, first of all, the theme and the topic about, you know, anti-industrial technology and revolution. And so we published it. Eventually, the New York Times agreed to publish it. But we then picked the Washington Post because there were only two locations in San Francisco that sold the Washington Post. And my profiling training told me he would want a souvenir. So we did put surveillances on everybody that morning who, in fact, bought a Washington Post.
So when you argued that there are some interesting ideas here that will get read, it wasn't like you felt like you wanted to propagate these ideas. Your point was people will read this, they will share it with others, and somebody will recognize them. It was really an investigative move.
It absolutely was. And I wasn't there to propagandize for the sake of the Unabomber. You know, he hated big government. He hated big entertainment. He hated leftists. He hated basically anything to do with modern technology, computers, psychology. There wasn't too much he didn't hate except farmers and, you know, some of the sciences like entomology, you know, studying bugs and insects. And these were okay to him. But psychology and all these other wasted fields were just no good to him.
So this paid off, right? Ted Kaczynski's sister-in-law, who recognizes the ideas and the writing, and she tells her husband, Ted Kaczynski's brother, David Kaczynski, gosh, they get a lawyer, they contact the FBI. Then what's your role?
Yeah, just going back a little bit, it's really the first time the internet was ever used to solve a crime. The early days of FBI.gov, and I love how the Chris North character had to look down while he's giving his little speech to the media. Yeah, and if you check www, and he's turning his head like he's just not you, you know, .fbi, because the internet was so new then, but she was actually in Paris at a conference, checked the computer, started going through it. And here, she never even met her brother-in-law, Ted Kaczynski, but she read lots of the letters and documents he sent to her husband, David. And she comes home and basically says, you should look at this thing. And he's like, yeah, right, my brother, the Unabomber. He wouldn't hurt a fly. But the term that finally convinced him, that the topics and themes similar in some ways, the things they talked about, but the term that convinced David was, quote, cool-headed logician, end quote. Ted was referring to somebody in the past as a cool-headed logician, and there that word is in the manifesto. That's when David realized. So like you said, lawyers are involved. They call the FBI. And then I'm now back in Quantico. My boss has wanted me back to work some cases in Quantico. I was only on temporary assignment to San Francisco. And that's when I was contacted again by the bosses at the UTF, Unabomber Task Force.
They sent you material that the family had provided, saying these are writings from decades before of this guy, Ted Kaczynski, who might be the Unabomber. And they asked you to look at those writings, compare them to the writings that you know were mailed by the Unabomber. And you told them what?
Actually, it was one 23-page document David provided to the FBI. My copy was probably the sixth generation of a fax, but I could read it. I would just call and say, Jim, we're going to fax you something. Check it out and let me know what you think. And I've been faxed other documents before and said, nah, I don't see the Unabomber's writing style in here. They sent me this thing, and not only did the format match, but it was actually written in the same chronological order as the manifesto. And lots of the same terms, inserting electrodes into the brain, you know, terminology like this. And it goes on and on and on. And finally, in the same exact order, the manifesto is written. And I realized to myself, this is essentially an outline, a well-crafted outline of the manifesto.
Written decades before.
Well, that's what I was told. And but to make sure, when the boss called me back and he said, Jim, what do you think? Actually, it was Fitz, what do you think? And I said, you have one of two things here. This is an elaborate plagiarism. Someone got the Washington Post version of the manifesto, got an old typewriter, got some old paper, and sat down and just made their own little fun outline and then gave it to David Kaczynski, whatever. Or, it's just a few simple words, or you've got your man. They said, Fitz, thank you. You're coming back out to San Francisco.
You actually worked in the preparation of the search warrant, right? Because the fact is the FBI knew where Ted was. They truly believed he was the Unabomber. But until they got the evidence, they couldn't prove it. They can't get the evidence until they get the right to enter his cabin. So you have to have a prosecutor go to a judge and say, this is why we believe he's the Unabomber. And it comes down to your linguistic analysis.
Yeah. And there was some tangential evidence that was slowly being put together in Montana about some bus trips and you know, dates and places, things like that, but nothing linking him to the bombs. It really came down to an affidavit that I was slowly building from late February of 96 through late March of 96, basically about 4.5 weeks. And it came down to about 600 separate blocks of individual phraseology, sentences, short paragraphs in which we had virtually identically written sentences from Ted Kaczynski and the Unabomber. They weren't exact, not necessarily word for word, but I mentioned earlier about the in paragraph 185, well, you can't eat your cake and have it too. Well, the big bonus day for me was when I'm sitting back and I'm the first one that looked at all the documents, copies of documents. I'm looking at document T-137, I'll never forget, and it's an early 70s letter to the editor to the old Saturday Evening magazine. And lo and behold, it's something about the evils of the environment being polluted, technology, all these type of things. At the very end, it says, you can't eat your cake and have it too, signed Theodore J. Kaczynski. I called my bosses together, got the prosecutor upstairs from his separate office. Look what I just found, guys. And it's one of those holy you-know-what moments, Dave. And the prosecutor finally, who was a little bit doubtful of what I was doing, I said, I think we just made our case, certainly for a search warrant. And for the first time in criminal justice history, as far as I ever knew, language as evidence, this wasn't handwriting analysis now, but language assessment as evidence was used to attain a search warrant. And it really created legal precedence at that time.
Ted Kaczynski lived as a hermit for years and years. You visited the cabin at some point. What was that like? What did you see?
It was a very almost out-of-body experience walking through this man that's been hunted for 17 years, his cabin. We now know he's a genius. He's a mathematical savant. And, you know, he did all these things and kind of abandoned all that. And now it's all about anti-technology. So as an early habit of mine, ever at a crime scene, hands in pockets. You don't want to touch anything you shouldn't touch. But I did walk through. And the bosses even said, Fitz, you may want to walk through on your own. We know, you know, the profiling part of you wants to see how this guy lived. And what was ironic, the first 3 days after the arrest, was actually a robot that was crawling through his cabin.
Because it could have been booby-trapped.
There could have been booby-trapped, looking for bomb pieces, devices, whatever. And we thought how ironic that would be if Kaczynski, Mr. Anti-Technology, knew there was a state-of-the-art for 1996 robot, you know, running through his cabin. But now robot's gone, the place is rendered safe, and there I am looking at the books on shelves and various tool components, a harpsichord on the wall, 22 rifle, a wooden cot. It really had no mattress because he wrote to his brother, a mattress makes a man soft, so he slept on just a piece of plywood. He had covers on him, of course. And, of course, just the wood-burning stove, no electricity, no running water. And it was just amazing taking all this in. And so for the first time, all these profiles either I read or helped construct in the last 8 months and all the language I broke down, now I'm looking at the immediate environment of this person. And this was his environment. This 10-foot by 12-foot cabin was everything. This was his self-imposed cell before he was sentenced to a real cell at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. So it told us everything about this guy. And of course, the additional language we found in the additional documents told us even more.
Well, James R. Fitzgerald, Fitz, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
James R. Fitzgerald is a retired FBI agent and criminal profiler. His work is the basis for the scripted miniseries Manhunt Unabomber. It airs Tuesday nights at 10 on the Discovery Channel. Random House has teamed with Lena Dunham, the creator and star of Girls, and the show's producer and writer Jenny Connor, to launch a new imprint called Lenny. The first book to be printed under the Lenny label is a collection of short stories called Sourheart, written by Jenny Zhang, a poet and writer who emigrated with her family from China to Flushing, Queens when she was five. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
The most famous line from Girls, Lena Dunham's show that ran for 6 seasons, occurred in episode 1 of the first season. That's the moment when Dunham, in character as aspiring writer Hannah Horvath, makes this declaration to her parents.
I think that I may be the voice of my generation, or at least a voice of a generation.
That line has been deconstructed to death. Dunham haters ripped it for its narcissism. Dunham herself insists it was a throwaway, meant to be just a joke. The one uncontested certainty about that line is that voice, raw, needy, original, feminist, loud, funny, bold, and obscene, is what Dunham is all about as an artist. Little wonder, then, that in launching a new publishing venture called Lenny Books, Dunham says she wants to showcase young writers because of their voices. Which brings us to Jenny Zhang and her debut short story collection, Sour Heart, the first book to be published under the Lenny imprint. Zhang definitely has a voice, or as we used to say in Queens, which is the chief setting for the 7 stories in this collection, she sure has a mouth on her. Zhang's stories, like Dunham's, are mostly told through the perspective of girls, Except the girls in these interconnected tales are the daughters of Chinese immigrants who've landed in the dumpy outer borough reaches of New York City in the 1990s. The parents, artists and professionals back in China, are hanging on by their fingernails in America, moving every few months with their kids from one illegally shared tenement apartment to another. Some of this New York immigrant experience material is timeless. For instance, in the first story, called We Love You, Crispina, a girl reflects back on her family's struggle and says, "Everyone said it was normal to go through hell our first year in America, but no one prepped us for our second year." That's a line you could imagine emanating from the mouth of some cheeky kid in the Lower East Side circa 1909. But most of Zhang's situations and language are far more violent and sexually explicit than the classic immigrant tale. These girls aren't sheltered. How could they be when they're sleeping on mattresses on a floor shared by their parents and three other families? They're tough and knowing, and they sound like it, although you can also hear vestiges of a childish vulnerability in their voices. In one of the most moving and graphic stories here, called The Empty, The Empty, The Empty, a 9-year-old girl named Lucy complains that her immigrant parents are always taking in strays. Zhang, by the way, tends to write in paragraph-long sentences, perhaps as a way of conveying the near panicked intensity of her girls. So here's only a snippet of Lucy's extended monologue on those strays. "We were running the world's first $0-a-night hotel and let all kinds of randos in. Sometimes it was a young family recently emigrated from a small village in Hunan, who all smelled so bad I had to stick cotton balls up my nostrils. Or else it was a young Taiwanese woman my mother met in the supermarket, who had all kinds of weird facial tics we weren't allowed to even react to, because my mother said this woman had lived a traumatic life beyond anything you could ever imagine. And I said, well, I can imagine anything, so that doesn't count." Despite her hard attitude, Lucy ends up being bullied by another girl into tying up and trying to have sex with her terrified fourth-grade boyfriend. It's a grotesque scene, but one in which Zhang deftly swirls in Lucy's resentment at her crowded immigrant home life with her lost feeling of being all on her own to figure out how to be an American adolescent. Most of Zhang's other stories in Sour Heart are also simultaneously tough to read and yet worth it. There's something very compelling about young girls in fiction and in life who speak up. And if their voices are rude, funny, even offensive sometimes, all the better. Given this fierce debut, I'll be giving the other voices Dunham finds a careful listen.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Sour Heart by Jenny Zhang. Coming up, performer Bridget Everett. She's known for her raunchy comedy cabaret act. Now she co-stars in the new movie Patty Cakes. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fifth Generation Incorporated, maker of Tito's Handmade Vodka, still independently owned by Tito Beverage, distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas, American-made and gluten-free. Recipes and more at titosvodka.com. And from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest is Bridget Everett, who Amy Schumer described as her absolutely bar none favorite performer to see live. Everett's been featured on Schumer's TV series and was in Schumer's movie Trainwreck. Everett's comedy cabaret act was described in Vogue as vaudeville meets raunchy storytelling set to filthy, hilarious, and really pretty vocals. Her costumes are designed to comically reveal as much of her six-foot body as possible. In 2015, she received a special citation at the Obie Awards, the Off-Broadway Theater Awards. She's collaborated with Adam Horovitz from the Beastie Boys and musical songwriters Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman. Now she's co-starring in the new movie Patty Cakes, and she spoke with Terry last week. In the film, Everett's character Barb used to be in a local rock band that never made it. She's become bitter, relegated to singing at a local dive bar in New Jersey. Her daughter wants to make it as a rapper, but Barb is uninterested in rap and assumes her daughter will also be crushed by her unfulfilled dreams. Here's a scene from the film. Barb is at the bar singing an 80s song.
Didn't get a I got in a fight, uh-huh. It ain't no big thing, but I know what I like. I know I like dancing with you. And you know what I like. You know I like dancing with you. Dancing with you. Come on, kiss me once, kiss me twice. Come on, pretty baby, kiss me, daddy. Come on, kiss me once, kiss me twice.
That's Bridget Everett singing in the new movie Patty Cakes. Bridget Everett, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Have you sung in a lot of bars like this one? Have you sung karaoke in a lot of bars?
Yeah, I mean, that's where I spent my formative years. I mean, by formative years, I mean my 20s and 30s. But yeah, I love a karaoke bar.
So this role in Patty Cakes is, to my knowledge, your first big role where, like, you're a leading character. Are there things you had to learn in preparation for the movie?
Yeah, you know, I'd never done a dramatic role before, and I've never taken an acting class or anything. But Jeremy, the writer-director of Patty Cakes, was involved in the Sundance Labs and thought that I should come and give it a shot. He saw me singing on Inside Amy Schumer and, you know, running around and, you know, being wild and stuff. And he's like, you should be the mother in my movie. And he kind of just took the pressure off. He's like, come to Sundance, you know. Don't worry about getting it wrong. Just come here, and I think this is all going to work out. And so I just took the chance.
Was there anything that you drew on as the mother in this movie from your own experiences or from your experiences with your own mother?
Yeah, you know, Barb is equal parts Bridget, frustrated as a waitress for many years, and my mom, who, you know, was a single mother and bitter, you know, and sort of the drinking part to get you through pain is not something that was too hard to tap into. And then also, you know, I feel like Barb is really lonely, and both my dad and sister had died a couple years ago, and I don't know, I guess I just had some sadness I needed to work through, and Barb kind of helped me do that.
In the movie, your character, the mother, kind of blames her own daughter for the end of her singing career, for the end of the mother's singing career, because she was a single mother and she couldn't pursue her dreams. She had to raise her child.
Yeah.
And the daughter knows this. It's like not the best way to establish a great relationship with your daughter, to blame them for shattering your dream.
It's so mean.
Yeah. I'm hoping that your mother didn't do that to you.
No, my mom didn't do that. But I can relate to blaming anybody but yourself, you know, for not achieving what you want. You know, I think that that's something that probably a lot of people can relate to. But my mom wasn't like that. I'm her favorite.
Did you have a list of people who you blamed for a few years before you established yourself?
Oh, just about everybody but myself. I was like, the audience doesn't understand me. Comedy clubs don't want to, you know, they don't want to book me. Agents don't want me. You know, they don't understand me, you know. Like, there's, yeah, for sure, anger and frustration. But I guess that's why I loved the gay community so much, because they just accepted me.
So I want you to describe your cabaret act.
You know, it's sort of like a rock and roll, punk rock cabaret, lots of tender moments and money notes. And, you know, it's a wild ride for sure. And it's definitely blue and it's not for everybody. But I also try to mix in stories that are, you know, part of the pain and part of the stuff that keeps me ticking. So it's not just all in your face. But, yeah, I sing and write my songs and all that, too.
It is literally in your face. Like, you put yourself in people's faces.
Yeah.
And when you say it's blue, it's not just like language blue. It's like physically blue. You reveal a lot of yourself emotionally and physically on stage.
Yeah.
So how did you arrive at that persona, at the person on stage who's almost like aggressively sexual with the audience?
I think that just for so many years I couldn't get anyone to listen to me, you know, or a job singing, and all I ever really wanted to be was a singer. The persona sort of came on as an afterthought. You know, I was singing in karaoke bars and I was getting up on top of the bar and like ripping my shirt open and just going nuts. And then I found cabaret and the performance art scene in New York, and people were just so wild and so alive. I was like, oh my God, this is what I've been waiting for. And so, I don't know, I feel like it's not meant to be like sexually explicit. It's more meant to be about the power of owning your own body and who you are, you know, and that's who I am. I'm just, you know, I've always sort of had a blue sense of humor, and I'm not really ashamed of my body, or at least my stage persona isn't. And it's just a different way of gaining acceptance, I suppose.
So there's the audience who comes to see you because they know who you are and they want what you are offering. And there's the audience who kind of stumbles into seeing you and they have no idea what they're in store for. So what kind of response do you get from people who kind of showed up without really knowing how raunchy your act really is?
Yeah, well, you know, it's not like I haven't had people walk out, and I kind of like that, because it's like, you know, I want people to have a reaction. I'd rather be doing something that thrills people or, you know, disgusts them. but honestly, the audience is what shaped my performance. They kept wanting more and more of me, and I just kept giving it to them until I felt I'd found, like, my sweet spot and my voice. So, you know, people will come back again and again, and sometimes they'll bring their mother or their grandmother or their kids or something, and it's kind of insane. But when I go out on the road and, like, people bring their grandmothers, you know, I'm talking, like, on this last tour I did, there were a lot of, like, Roses for some reason. It'd be like, Rose, hey, Rose, what are you doing here tonight? How old are you? And I'm 90. And she would just, like, bring down the house every time. It's fun when you can get somebody like that to unlock and let go.
So I want to play one of your songs from an album that you recorded, and this is a song you often perform in your act, and you did it on your Comedy Central special, which was called Gynecological Wonder, which helps give an idea
of
your
little
act.
A little taste, right?
Yeah. So why don't you talk a little bit about Stay With Me?
You know, I wanted
to play something beautiful, and I wanted to also play something that we could play on the air.
Yeah. Well, Stay With Me, I wrote with my guitar player, Mike Jackson, and I wanted it to be like Last Call at the Bar and sort of have like, a romantic 70s kind of vibe or something. And, I wanted it to be like a love song, but a love song that was in my way of doing it.
Okay. So this is Bridget Everett singing Stay With Me.
Hey, old friend.
Come sit with me. Don't be lonely tonight. Oh, please. Take my hand. We'll dance under the moon as slow as we can. Or stay right here till the night is through. 'Cause there ain't nothing in this world but me and you. 'Cause tonight you're all I need. You stay with me.
That's Bridget Everett singing Stay With Me. I mean, that's really beautiful. Did you try for a straight singing career for a while? Like, what did you do to try for just a straightforward singing career?
Well, I went to school and I studied opera. I got my degree in vocal performance. And then I moved to New York so I could, like, try Broadway and all that. And I got my Equity card really quick doing a children's theater tour. But I quickly realized that it just wasn't for me. There was, you know, there's not a lot of roles for somebody like me. And I just was more suited to, like...
What do you mean, somebody like you?
Well, I'm 6 foot tall. I'm like, I've got a big build, you know. I can't think of anybody that sort of looks like me that was up on the Broadway stage a lot, you know, and I can't dance. And, you know, I just sort of felt like I had to make a path for myself. And so I just started singing and telling stories and got into that cabaret life. And I'm really happy that I found it because it's just opened up my heart and my world and everything. I love it so much.
When you were studying opera, did you expect to become an opera singer, or was that just a good way of learning as much as you could about your voice and how to use
it? It was a good way to get out of Kansas. You know, I got a scholarship. Yeah. And but yeah, I really wanted to learn how to do it the right way because I used to lose my voice a lot, and I wanted to learn how to be a really good singer. I just love singing so much. And so it was good to get, like, the, you know, the mechanics of how to do it right. But I realized that, like, I would take the languages, you know, that's all part of the curriculum. And I have no retention. I can't retain languages. And I'm like, I'm in the wrong line of work. I got to get out of here. And I didn't feel really that. I loved singing an aria. It'd be super exciting, but not like I felt when I was on top of a karaoke bar. So I just figured how to translate that into a job.
So what's the music that most inspired you when you were coming of age?
Oh, I really love Barry Manilow. And I also loved, like, Freddie Mercury and Debbie Harry and, you know, of course, Bette Midler. I just liked people that, you know, like when you see, like, Freddie Mercury perform, like how sort of he just seemed like his own particular thing, you know, and he's kind of wild and looked a little different. And it just gave me a lot of hope that there was a space for me somewhere.
Where does Barry Manilow fit in? Because he's more of like a songwriter craftsman and pop singer. Seems really different than what you're doing.
Yeah, I think it's like the unabashed, like he just says what's on his heart and mind, you know, and I really like that. And I love all the key changes and just the drama of it. And, you know, it's sort of the soundtrack of my youth. There was a lot of nights where my mom would be sitting in her blue chair having a scotch and I'd be brushing her hair and we'd be listening to Manilow and she'd be crying. And I don't know, it just sort of brings me back to the sweet life.
So I'm wondering if you were influenced by performers in gay clubs.
Oh, yeah. That's what changed my life. When I moved to New York, my friend took me to Fez and the Time Cafe, and that's where I saw Murray Hill and Kiki and Herb. And I was a big fan of Sweetie, who's a drag queen who passed away just a few months ago. And just like the sort of vital nature of their performance and just like the, you know, not to be corny, but like the coloring outside of the lines kind of thing, and crawling on tables and just, you know, sometimes just totally sick humor, but also, you know, the ones that I responded to were the ones that just had a lot of heart sort of pulsating underneath it. And I didn't know that existed living in Kansas and then going to school in Arizona. So They are constantly inspiring me, for sure.
What are the things that made you feel most different when you were in front of audiences, not gay audiences, but audiences who you felt weren't getting what you did?
I think, like, I'm physically different. I don't see a lot of people on stage that look like me. I don't see a lot of people on stage that are, you know, wearing plunging, you know, a gown that goes all the way down to their navel, that are built like me, that are swinging it all around. You know, I think, like, I am. And then just, like, going out into the audience and just being like a wild child. Like, somebody used to call me a cabaret hurricane, and I just feel like, I don't know why, but queer audiences just ate it up and treated me like I belonged there.
You single out people and bring them onto stage to either dance or put people's heads onto your chest. And I'm wondering, like, if you ever choose the wrong person, like the person who, like, is very shy about this kind of thing and wants to see your performance but doesn't really want to be a part of it because they're just not that kind of person. You know what I mean? They want to just sit and watch. They don't want to have other people be looking at them.
Yeah, I think by that point in the show, you can sort of tell who's going to be willing to,
how can
to
you
go
tell?
All the way. I don't know. It's like, you don't want somebody that's like, pick him. And you don't want somebody that's just like white knuckled clinging to their seat. You know, there's someone that lies in the middle that's kind of looking at you. Like, you know, when I walk through the audience, if somebody's looking down, but there'll always be somebody that just sort of peeks up a little and I'm like, perfect, I gotcha. I found you. Or there's been somebody that I've been talking to throughout the show and sort of getting to know them, and that is often the person I pick. But I've gotten pretty good at it. I mean, I've had a couple missteps. I remember I was sitting on some guy's lap one time, and he was older, because I love the AARP set. I'm always so delighted when they come to this kind of show. And I was sitting on his lap, and he whispered in my ear, I just had my knee replaced.
Oh, God.
So there's always something like that, you know, but I think I've gotten pretty good at it.
Well, how did you respond when you found out about his knee replacement?
Oh, I freaked out. I was like, oh, my God, I felt horrible, you know, and he was fine, you know, but I made a big stink about it. Stop the song. Cut the track. What have I done?
Well, Bridget Everett, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. This was a delight. Thanks for having me.
Bridget Everett speaking with Terry Gross. Everett co-stars in the new movie Patty Cakes, and she has a new pilot called Love You More that will be on Amazon starting September 1st. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.